As I contemplated our reading this morning, the image that came to my mind was of my grandson, Charlie. Charlie is 6 years old, and Christmas was a big time for him. He believed with all his heart. And I would go over there, and he would greet me at the door, and he'd say, "Honey, come and look." And we'd go to the Advent calendar. He'd say, "How many days were left?" And there was the Christmas tree and the stockings, and he'd count them out, one for Mommy, Daddy, Calvin, Charlie. And he had a special apron so that he could do the Christmas baking with his mother. And his apron had tulips all over it, was red. And he turned to his mother one day. They were putting the buttons on the gingerbread men in the cookies. And he said, "This is what Christmas is all about." And you have to just love that innocence. You have to love it. And then Christmas came, and he opened all of his gifts, and I was there, and we exclaimed over this one and over that one. And then it was over. And Charlie says to me, "Honey, Christmas isn't coming for another whole year." And I remember as a child thinking about that concept of a year. And for a child, that's just infinite. I couldn't even imagine it. All those things you had to go through until Santa Claus came again. And Charlie was experiencing that innocence of childhood, that ignorance which comes from innocence. And he will be disillusioned at some point, just like I was. When one day I was around six or seven, I went up the hill outside my house, and my little neighbor boy friend was there. His name was John Meany. And John was a meanie. And he disillusioned me in that moment. And I said, "You're crazy." And he said, "You're stupid." And I said, "You shouldn't talk like that." And he said, "It's a lie." And I went home to my mother and I said, "Mom, John Meany told me this." And I could see on her face what the truth was. She didn't even have to say anything. So that's, you know, those are instances of someone coming into greater knowledge, going from innocence to knowledge. But then what came to my mind was the memory of our field trip last fall when Gary and I took the middle school kids to Point Reyes, and we had a glorious week. We were at the beach. It was warm and sunny. The kids frolicked in the surf. We went hiking up in the mountains. Everything was perfect. And then on the way back, we stopped. Perfect day, blue skies, just a mild wind, sunshine, and we took the boat out to take a tour of Alcatraz. And Alcatraz, for those who may not know, is that penitentiary that's only for those inmates who really couldn't be contained in other penitentiaries. It's for the most serious offenders. And I had lived in San Francisco, grown up all my life there, looked out from my parents' bedroom, and saw Alcatraz in the distance in between the two bridges. But I'd never gone there. And so all of that sunshine and blue sky and mild wind never made its way inside those walls of that prison. We took the tour. It was a very good tour. And I was impressed by the feeling, the reality, and the vibration of heaviness and darkness and dampness. Everything that is the antithesis of our desires as espoused in this reading today. Yet, there was one story on our tour of an inmate. There were many stories, actually, of inmates who tried to grapple with their reality. And God knows, some may have been there mistakenly. Who knows what the karma was? But certainly some, because of deeds that they had performed out of great ignorance, where they aspired for happiness, but did it from ego and not from egolessness. And so there's this one prisoner, and he acts out, and he gets put into solitary. And solitary was a nightmare. Solitary was darkness for 23 hours of the day. And he told his story. He wrote it down, and he said, I would lie there, and I would close my eyes in the darkness, and I would concentrate at the point between the eyebrows. And he said, and if I did that long enough, sometimes I could see a little speck of light. And once in a while, if I really concentrated, that light would expand. And he said, that was lovely. He had no context for it. He didn't know, only that that was lovely. And we here, listening to that story, have our own ideas about what was really happening. The light shone in the darkness, and the darkness knew it not, right? So the ignorance out of egocentricity is really serious. And not all of us are without ego. We don't end up at Alcatraz. But we do wend our way through life, falling into little potholes of ego here and there. And of course, the goal is to increase our awareness of truth, truth in God, so that we don't do that. Now, when I was thinking about what I wanted to share with you, my thoughts kept going back to that time in life when I found Ananda. And it was a time when I was in my own solitary cell of confinement. It was mental. I was in a box and I couldn't get out. And it seemed pretty dark. And I didn't know what to do. I felt powerless. And I felt alone. And I called out to God. And I said, help me. I don't really like the way my life is going. But I don't know where to turn. I actually gave God an ultimatum. I said, you've got 6 months. He took 8. But in the course of that time, circumstances came about that steered me in the direction of Ananda, whose existence I knew nothing about until that time. When I went to Ananda, I had 2 small children. Well, they were 4 and 6. And I had very little money. Ananda wasn't a place of wealth. It wasn't at the very beginning of Ananda. It was about 10, 12 years in, maybe a little more. But there wasn't a whole lot of infrastructure. There were no roads. It was all mud and dirt. And housing was at a minimum. And so I had to live off of the land for the first year, even though I worked and prayed and had friends at the community. This is Ananda in Nevada City on Tyler Foot Road. This Ananda didn't exist. None of the communities existed. There was no Portland, there was no Seattle, no Italy, no India, nothing. It was Ananda Village. And so I spent a year off the land, but I had this deep desire to be on the land. There was something about the land. You could feel it when you walked onto it, and you felt it when you walked off of it. As a matter of fact, our custom was that when we were in a car, I might have the 2 kids in the back seat, we're in the car and we're heading out, we would stop right at the entrance to Ananda and say a little prayer. We hoped it would hold us over until we got it back. So I had an opportunity to move on to the land, but the opportunity was to move into this converted chicken house and goat shed. And it was really bad. Those people who knew anything about architecture and house building just shook their heads like this. Helen, you can't really think you're going to do this. And I said, oh, yes, I am. I am moving onto the land. So there was a man in the community whose job was to lay carpet. Now, this place, it was so bad that we had to put wood over the holes in the floors. And there was no foundation. It was just, there was a shower and a bath, but the water just went right out onto the earth. So he came in and he said, you know, I just had a job at MGM Hotel. I think it was Reno or was it Las Vegas? I don't know. But he said, they gave me the remnants. I had to replace the lobby. And I've got the old carpet. Do you want some of it? It'll fit in here. I said, sure. He says, it's free. It's free. I said, I can't refuse that. So what that meant was that when you stepped into my little abode, you stepped onto a carpet that was filled with medallions of the MGM lion. It was about this big, all over. And I thought to myself, that's not too bad on the spiritual path. One wants to be a lion. But the rest of the house was pretty, You know, we had a wood stove. My living room was about 8 by 8. My bed was a little window seat on one side of the living room. There was room for a wood stove. And I had my little altar and one stuffed chair. And then the kids had their little bedrooms. One winter, we counted the leaks. There were 25 in the roof. And not one, this is the miracle, not one was over a bed. The frogs used to come up the drain when you were taking a shower. And they would leap on you. It was unsettling. One day I was in there taking a shower, and I don't know what caused me to look, but I suddenly noticed that the frogs had come in, yes, but also the snake had come in, and it had aligned itself where the tub met the wall. So I hadn't really quite noticed it. It was about this big. It was something. It was something. But, you know, those were hardships, and it was a travail, really, to take care of the infrastructure of my life. But there was something else that was going on amidst all of that. And the image that came to me was that of the bell tolling in the early, early morning up on the hill by the retreat, what we now know as the Expanding Light. And I would hear it. It'd be 5:30 or so. And I would roll out of bed. I'm not one of these who stays in bed. I would put my robe on. There was a little back door that led out to the hillside outside my house. And I would stand there under the eaves and I would do my energization exercises. And I would run back in. By that time, having stirred the fire before I left, it would be warm a little bit. And I would sit and I would meditate. The children were asleep. The day hadn't begun, and there was this extraordinary vibration in those moments. We had the Sierra Nevada foothills, the forest, the big sky. We had my little shack, and it all seemed to work. And we all worked. Most of us worked there. Some worked outside of the community. But at lunchtime, the bell would ring at noon, and everybody would stop what they were doing, and we would have a half hour of meditation. And then we'd all tumble out down the hill. I was working at Pubble, the publications building, which is now Hansa Temple. And we'd head onto the market. People who were in Ayodhya, where Swami lived, would come over. People who worked up at the clinic up Tyler Foot Road, caring for not just Ananda, but all the people who lived in the area, the doctors, the nurses, the secretaries, would come down, and we would meet at Master's Market. And we would all sit there and have satsang while we had lunch. And then we'd go off back to work. And so it went, day by day. And it doesn't mean that life wasn't going on, that we were living in this airy-fairy perfect world, because it wasn't. There were relationship problems, there were financial problems, there were work problems, friendship problems, you name it. It was a human crucible, of course. But overlying all of that, there was joy that wafted through the air, captured in song, a lot of song. We sang everywhere, for any reason, the drop of a pin. And it was a different way of being. Now, I'm saying all this and I'm thinking, oh no, you're wishing you could have been there and you'll never get to have that experience and oh no. But the reality is that here, years later, at Ananda Palo Alto, the same reality holds true. And it is our best reality for piercing that darkness that keeps us from understanding that the light is here. It's all about us. We have only to know it. And that reality is in the reality of community. All of us gathered here this morning, meditating together. It was in the Christmas and the New Year's celebrations when we came together, that 8-hour meditation, the devotion, the alignment of like-minded souls all pointed in the same direction towards God has an authentic ability to change us. And it's not just our efforts that we put out. It's everybody's effort together. It's a big family. And when one falls, the others pull him up or her up. And when one stumbles, they get righted. And we're in it together. So that sense of spiritual community that we have here is something that we must really venerate. There's nothing quite like it. Sometimes I go home, I work at the school. It's been a rough day. We have our rough days. I have a parent. The parent's unhappy. That's the worst. Or the child is unhappy or whatever. And we work through it. But I go home, and where do I go? When I can get home early enough. I go to the community room for dinner. And all of us come together who have dinner from different points of origin. Many of us here in Palo Alto are working out in the world. And this world is so different from the world of Ananda Village in the 1980s. It's so different. Instead of the Sierra Nevada foothills and the quiet of the morning when we're meditating, well, we have the train. And we thank God for earplugs and earphones, don't we? And instead of walking to work through the fields and over the hills and through the draw, which doesn't exist anymore, but we have El Camino Real. And the traffic and the commute. You should see my parents when they show up and they're trying to get to school on time, but there's been an accident on 280 or 101. I mean, it's just harrowing, and you know this. And we have Stanford Shopping Mall just down the way. We can, at an arm's reach, get a pizza or a Starbucks coffee. None of that was there. But what is here is that energy and that intensity, that determination to move through the darkness to the light. And Swamiji said, when the thought form of a community in Palo Alto first came up, Swamiji said, that's where the energy is. It's not in San Francisco. It's in Palo Alto. It's in Silicon Valley. The creativity, the ability to see, to have foresight. So, aren't we lucky? And shouldn't we hold that tight to us, knowing that whatever ignorance, whatever inclination we have to miss the point, ultimately, if we hold the realities of community, of spirit, of meditation, of joy close to our hearts, we'll always make our way through. Now, where are we going? Well, last summer on pilgrimage to Italy, one of our first stops in Rome, as I recall, was to the church of Santa Maria de Vittoria. And we went there because there was this beautiful bronze sculpture by Bernini of St. Teresa of Avila. St. Teresa of Avila was a great Christian mystic and wonderful. About what was wonderful about her was that she wrote down, so that we have it, her thoughts on her own experiences. Well, the sculpture is about St. Teresa in ecstasy. And I'm sure some of you have seen it. in person, if not in a portrait. But there's the angel, and the angel is standing ready to loose the arrow of ecstasy at St. Teresa. And St. Teresa is like this, reclining in a half-sitting position, receptive to receive whatever the Lord wants to give her. And she writes about this. She says, the tip of the arrow was fire. And she said, when it pierced my entrails, I felt such ecstatic joy. And you see it on her face. Now, there's a word that they have come up with to describe this. It's called transverberation. But all that it means is that God enters in. God comes. The light comes, and we become one. And St. Teresa is the emblem, and all the other mystics and saints out there who have had that experience of light. And when you have it, from all I've read, all you want to do is to share it. We are the beneficiaries of all who have gone before. But we have a special thing about us. We have hitched our wagons to a certain star. And that star is Master and Swami Kriyananda. And so we cannot fail. We cannot fail. The only question is, how long is it going to take? That's the only question. And so let us together, in spiritual community, line up all our wagons and go in the same direction. And when somebody lags, give them a boost. And when we lag, thank God for each other.